discussed in London, there's a shul that never gave a aliyah or a kibbutz to someone who carried on Shabbos. And an old man came to shul one Shabbos with his cane, and no one noticed the cane, and they gave him aliyah.
Well, the cane is the problem.
Well, the cane might be a cooler.
Yeah, if you left the shul
and saw him holding out with the cane, the rabbi said, pull out the Sefer Torah, we have to do the whole kriya again.
I had a guy in this shul wearing a black hat and a black suit, and I went over to him and said, go see him. So he said, I can't, I'm in the process of becoming a gayer.
No, it's all right. Listen, many years ago when I was in, I went one time, I forgot why in particular, but I went to visit, my uncle was a rabbi in Chicago, but I went to, I wasn't going to daven in the shul where he was the rabbi, let's put it that way. But anyhow, so I went to Rabbi Small, and where they ended up davening later when he became a rebbe in the yeshiva and he gave up his shtela. So I was davening there, and I just sat there, you know, you're a guest, whatever it is, but they didn't give me any aliyah. When I came back from Mincha Ma'ariv, they gave me Galila, and I'm wearing a black hat, you know, but whatever it is. And somebody came over to me after Galila, and they said hello to me, and they didn't know who I was, because they weren't used to seeing me. And they asked me who I was, and I said, my name is Mayevsky, and they said, oh, we must apologize. They said they didn't know because they didn't know who I was and they weren't sure I was a Shomer Shabbos or not. So they didn't give me an aliyah. They apologized because then when I told them my name, they realized you know all my relatives that were there. You know, even some of them were davening in the shul there, but they didn't. They just and they apologized that they only gave me. I said that's all right. I understand. I appreciate it. When I mentioned probably once before when I was when I wasn't wearing a black hat, I was at a wedding for a friend of mine who was, I met him in Israel on a tour when I was 21, and he got married to a nice frum girl from Flatbush, but he himself was in the process of becoming a Baal Tshuva. And he grew up in a family and totally not from, and he wasn't from, and now he just met a girl who was, and her father was a Holocaust survivor, and he was one of the bakers in Flatbush here, and he wasn't happy about the situation in the first place, but they got married, and he became a nice from person, but at the wedding, so the Masada Kedushin was Rabbi Kurzrak. And when he went to, when he asked Rabbi Kurzrak, said he's going to sign the ksuva, so he pointed to the one person that Rabbi Kurzrak knew, and then he asked, you know, he said, and fell this one. And Rabbi Kurzrak, who, I mean, I knew who he was, because I grew up on the east side, he was the principal of RJJ, and I said, and he looked at me and he said, excuse me, are you a Shomer Shabbos? I said, oh, I said, you don't know who I am? I said, my name is Mayevsky. So basically, what he was looking at me like, so what are you doing with this guy? You know, it's like, he says, but he said, I still didn't get an answer, you know. he wanted to know, he was guilt by association, but he had an attitude, was if I was this guy's friend, then nice still maybe
like
I'm not.
A place like this.
What?
Yeah,
but the point is, the girl's father that time was only accepted the fact that they would get married. The girl came over to me, his future wife, who I got to know at that point already a few times, she asked me to stay with him because that's the only way if I'll befriend them and, you know, go out with them a few times on a double date and keep a relationship, then her father would allow for the, you know, for the whole shidduch to continue. Otherwise, she wasn't exactly overly joyed. But it worked out very well. You know, he became, he was a very respectful person.
Marriage is rough. I don't think there's a single wedding that's not made by a rab. Called from the rabbanut, whatever.
Yeah, I understand.
And they make all the sheva brachas, which you only do with a minyan.
Right.
So some of those weddings, I don't think you have a single minyan of a yarmulke except under the chuppah. But they make the
Sheva Brachos. Yeah, listen, it's, you know, there's a lot of things that, so, listen, you do the best you can. My father, when I, early on in my life, he always, because not because I had any responsibilities as a Rav, but because I was teaching bar mitzvah lessons from the time I was 15, and he gave me like a template. He told me exactly what I should, you know, he gave me a line of, you know, where I draw the line in the sand with some of these fellas. When you ask, he started outlining for me things to say or do, or where I have to say no, yes, 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 here is where we, you know, you can't bend anymore. Certain rules you could bend a little bit, and certain rules are where you draw the line in the sand. And they really stood me in good stead, because the truth is, you know, I never appreciate, I just assumed all the time, you know, you grow up a certain way from the time you're a little kid. My father was always very careful to make sure I was with him, and that's the problem you have with junior minion. It's the parents, you know, even if the parents are not so AI, but they generally, they see what's going on in the world, and the kids learn whatever it is. And that's why, like I mentioned, some children just, what they lose is that, or what the parents want the kids at a junior minion, because they don't want to see, they don't want their children to see how they act during davening. But the truth is, my father was like, you know, you wonder where I get, my father was a big bal digduk, and he would, when I, he sat, when I sat next to him davening, there were many times when he would just be, we would both be davening, and davening fast, and he would just be with one ear. He was listening to me, and every time I said a word wrong, he corrected me. He just would lean over and say, you know, he would, he heard, and he just, you know, said, he said the word correctly, my pronunciation wasn't correct, and he would say it. And then afterwards, when we came home, he would start drilling me on the, you know, binyan and the gzeros and things like that. And my grandfather was the same way. And that wasn't what he did for, you know, the, he didn't teach that, but, you know, it's like I inherited a sefer that I can't find now, but it's on, you know, binyan, kal and gzeros that we, me and my sister, were drilled on constantly. He just felt it was part of, his father did it to him.
In high school, we had
and that's it. But I just assumed that everybody was the same way. That was just the way I assumed. You know, when you're 6 years old and 8 years old, you don't realize other people are not in the same situation. You just assume. If you're Jewish and you're in yeshiva, and then you start to, you know, begin to grow up and see what's doing in the world, and you see different things. But anyhow, one thing that I just, because I can't come up with an answer, and I've been thinking about it, the one thing that I was thinking about this morning is, Rabbi Schwab mentioned in his sefer, I've mentioned it before, but I'm still trying to come up with an answer, and it's been mulling over in my mind. We have, when the Pasuk says, Eish asher yikro eskan b'achris hayomim, I don't know if this in particular I mentioned or expressed it properly at a previous time, and I know we brought it up in Shir at least once. It's strange that it's spelled with an aleph, the word yikore. And it should be spelled because what he does is he mentions, he says, he quotes the Targum. And the Targum on the Ki Kore is, you know, Mikra with a hey at the, I mean, he doesn't spell it with a hey, but he, the Targum. But nevertheless, he talks about it as Lashon Mikra. It happened, Ki Kore, you know, like Esa Sher Yikro, it should be what will happen. That's the way we tie it up. But Yikro with an aleph means to call. And why in particular does he use it with an aleph in the first place? It's very strange. And it shouldn't be that way. So there must be, naturally, everything is a message, everything is for a reason. And so what he says is, the answer is in the Lashon, right there, when he says, He kavtsu v'shimu b'nei Yaakov v'shimu el Yisrael avichem. Gather round. He says, what does he mean by the term Esa, you know, and Esfu v'yagidu lochem? Hey, Esfu, gather round, meaning if you will all gather round and be together. We need unity. So where he goes with this in general, because it's a long, like, column and a half, the Dvar Torah there, but the point is, because it strikes me all the time, as I know that when we were coming out of the one time when I was walking with you, Mark, and we were walking in Borough Park. I don't know if we were coming from a Levaya or whatever it is. Yeah, we were coming from a Levaya. I don't remember from who. But we passed Rabbi Alpert's son in the street. And he came over to me that time and said that I hear you're the person who always mentions my father, and I appreciate it. And what, you know, I felt good about it, and I developed a relationship with him because I didn't know him particularly. He was younger than his older brother that I did know, although both, all his kids were a lot younger than me, but a lot younger than I. But nevertheless, the reality is that he mentioned it. And the reason, so he says, Eis Hashem Yikra Eschem B'Acharis Hayomim. When I mention, he goes into the whole idea of Kola Omer Dover B'Shem Omro is maybe Gula. What does that mean? He says, I'm going to tell you the secret of how, in other words, I'm not going to give you dating on the Gula. That's not what I mean to tell you. I'm going to tell you how to achieve Gula, how Gula will arrive. This is the formula that when you're down and out, the way to bring the Gula is if everybody is unified and gets together. He kavtzu v'shimu b'nei Yaakov v'shimu el Yisrael avichem. When you're all together as a unified people, that's when. And how do we do that? It's not just a generational thing. It's from generation to generation. And how do we achieve that unity? Is every time I say something and I mention Rabbi Alpert or I mention another Rebbe that I had and I say it over and over again, you begin to feel on some level that you know this person. And there's a bond that begins to grow from one generation to the next generation. And so you feel you begin to know him. And to me, it later on in life, it's, I didn't know your father, Rabbi Levine's father. And I met him two or three times at a kiddush that from one of my, you know, family with Davin there, and they made a bris a couple of times, and they made it. So, you know, at the kiddush, somebody told me over, said, this is Rabbi Levine, and meet him like that. But over the years, all three of my sons who went to YU would forever and ever on at the Shabbos table, and then I began to ask, what did Rabbi Levine say this week? Moshe would tell me what you said in Shalosh Shuddos. But more often than not, where it started was they had your father for economics, all of them, and they would tell us the way he operated. And as much as I didn't really know him, I began to feel like I knew him. And because every week with my youngest son, he would tell me what, you know, in the class, what your father did was for that whole season that he had him that year was he would take the ethicist in the New York Times and dissect the article where it is, if it's correct according to Torah, and where it just leaves him behind. He says, yes, you know, with civil law, it's okay, but where it diverges from the Torah is thus and so, which is wonderful to have. I had my son, one of my sons had in his high school, a lot of the English teachers there were rebbeim. And these were, you know, not the old-style rebbeim. These were rabbis who were, one was a lawyer, one was an optician. I mean, I shouldn't say an optician, an eye doctor. And they opened up their office in the afternoon, and they wanted to be a rebbe in the morning. And eventually, they gave up their practice, and they were a rebbe full-time and even opened up a kollel. And that's what they did for a living. But they gave them, when they learned all the subjects in school, they learned it with hashkafa of the Torah. When they learned about evolution and biology, the teacher was a Rebbe, and he said, this is where it goes. It's good to have that, and we have the ability to have that today in this day and age, obviously. But so, Eis Hashem Yikra Eschem. But what I wanted to get to is where I'm, if anybody will think about it, that's why I say I like to pose the question is, how come by Ki Korei Kan Sipor is also with an Aleph? What is the message there? And my mind is working on it, and I begin a thought, and I haven't come up with anything that's worth repeating yet, but you put it out there. That's the way my Rebbeim would say, what do you think? In Kiseitse. Ki Yikorei Kansipor. It's also. So what does that mean? What is the Taich over there? I think along the lines where the Ramban says what, and I shouldn't say the Ramban, I mean the Abarbanel, just to Taich up what it means, Ki Yikorei Kansipor, because that story is where we learned in the Gemara that it says Elisha ben Avuya, that's what totally destroyed him. One of these things that he saw that somebody was going, climbing up a ladder to do that, to be Mekayim the Mitzvah, fell down and died, and why he was doing it. And he makes a point of saying that you're still doing it. Don't look. Some people nowadays, you see, they try to be Mekayim the Mitzvah. But the idea is when it happens, when it's a mikra, then that's what you do. Don't try to do the mitzvah when it's unnecessary. When you don't need the eggs, just to go up and take the eggs. You're still causing tzar to another animal, to a bird. You're causing tzar. Don't do it unless, you know, you need the eggs, you want to eat, fine. But if you don't need the eggs, don't go do it. It's not one of those mitzvahs where you have to try to achieve. This is, should it happen, ki kore, if it happens. But the point is, then why is it with an olive? What is it telling you? What is the message? So I put it out there. If somebody comes up with an answer, that's great. But that's the way your mind should be working, so to speak. That's what we want to get to. One thing that I mentioned over here, I brought in today just to see. This is that sefer printing the Talmud. What? By Marvin J. Heller. So, but it has pictures of old Shas and prints of old Fussim with Rashi, without Rashi, and everybody who printed, not printed before there was a printing press. Obviously, if I ask anybody who was the first Jewish printing press, I think you could probably guess. What was the name? Exactly. Cincino. What? Cincino. That was the very first Jewish printing press. And it's like, it's showing... This is a picture of a block from 1485. This is from, it says, from Brochos, Nunches, Amar Aleph, and Beis. Oh, this is Rashi. Does it say this is Rashi? I think it says this is Tosfos. No, it can't be Tosfos. But anyhow, it has to be Tosfos. No, Rambam, like I said... It has certain things, but this is Rashi. He makes a point of saying, because, by the way, he makes a point of saying that Rashi initially on some of the tfuses wasn't in Ksav Rashi.
But that's a printing press thing.
What?
That's a printing press.
Yeah. Well, when they started doing it initially, Rashi wasn't always printed in the Gemaras as we see it today with Ksav Rashi. It was printed as Hebrew, the same way. And they have pictures. It's amazing that they have, I guess they found old, obviously it's not a picture, I mean it's a picture now, but of old pieces of parchment they found through the centuries. And the reason what they tried to establish, what the Chachamim did in the end, was try to codify how many blot each Masechta was. That was the big thing that they did, because everybody from various countries, if it was in Spain, then this Masechta had X amount of blot, and if the Gemara was printed in France, the Gemara had X amount of blot, and it became very confusing as Judaism began to contract in those days, and people wanted to have a more unified way of discussing things with each other, and that's the only way they could come about doing it.
Either Moshe Feinstein, in the Daf Yomi cycle,
yeah,
there are now 2,711 daf. But they were less, I don't know the exact date, maybe in the 70s and 60s, it was based on an old printing of a Sech Shkolim.
Right.
That compressed into one page, like three daf.
Right.
And if Moshe says, why are you learning, it's too much for one day, take a different printing, and that should be part of the cycle.
Right.
And if Moshe single-handedly... He told the Aguda the official cycle should not be 2,600 whatever.
Right.
Whatever.
But so he has insight in doing things. And I. This was 1485.
So it was before the expulsion, or before the, maybe before the
Yes.
That's why it could be a Jewish, only a Jewish printer. After the Inquisition, there were Anusim, and there were, people who converted, who worked for the Goyish printers, and they were able to do.
So you're making a very interesting point where he deals with this in the thing, and he says he attributes where we have the Gilyon HaShas, there's so many there were so many mistakes. And how did the mistakes come about? Initially, there weren't so many mistakes because what would happen is, how was the Shas written? Just like any Sefer Torah, you would have a Sefer Torah in front of you and copy from a Sefer to a Sefer. The problem became, and actually there's a riff that gets into this and explains it on some level because of for the Sheva Brachos, the Brachos before, different wording that change. I remember in Ksuvis that we learned at one time, and he made a grammatical point of, why certain words are wrong in the Birchas Kedusha, Birchas Nisuin. So he says, and they say it was taking too long. Go like this, go like that, then right, go like this. So I had somebody, I'd say, listen, I'm going to hire somebody, he's going to sit next to me, and he's going to read to me what it says, and I'll transcribe it. You read it to me, it'll go faster, so I don't have to keep going like this, go like that, you read it to me. The problem is, there are a lot of letters that have the same sound. Most of the time, it was a vav and a vav, and that would be a big problem. And there were many, we have it a lot of times. Why certain words, did you ever think about in the Torah, a sota is always spelled with a sin. Always. It's never written with a samach. In the Gemara, it's only written with a samach. Ish ki sista ishto. It's only with a samach, with a sin. But we never think of it. When I'm writing my notes, I never write it with a sin. I would never do it because it doesn't. So you're trying to make it more phonetic. There's no limud with the samach, with the sit, whatever it is, because it could be confusing. Well, that's the one that the Rif mentions in Ksuvis. That's exactly. It says, al yidei chupa bikidushin, and because he says, osio sahevi, after bumaf, osio sahevi, don't take a dogesh, blah, 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 it's bikidushin, but since it's vikidushin, the person read it to him, and he wrote vikidushin. That's the Rif. I picture it on the wide lines on the from Daf Ches. But the point is, it's very interesting, and that's how it happened. But he said, but most of the mistakes that happen in the Shas that we have that you needed the Gilyon for, because since the presses were, it was against the law for the Jews to have their own printing press, and the Goyim controlled the printing press, and you would have the rabbis who would oversee the printing. There was one problem. The printing presses operated on Shabbos. And on Shabbos, you didn't have the rabbis there controlling the printing, watching to see that there were no mistakes. And a lot of mistakes got into, mostly the ones from the Shas, a blot that was printed on a Shabbos. That's where most of the mistakes come from. That's what he mentions in the book. I read through the book more than once. Wow.
So it means our Shas were done for Chil Shabbos.
Yes, initially. Not only that, but the original template for the opening blot had pictures of angels and naked ladies with the circles around it. He has pictures here of a Shas that had these pictures that would not fly in a yeshiva today.
It was a different time than also.
Yeah, but they had no choice. If they wanted a print, they had to have those opening the flowery things around the first Amud, Amud Beis, Amud Aleph. They had pictures of the original thing, and unfortunately, it had things. Listen, this is a Shas also. That's the way a Shas Gemara looked. What year does it say over here? 1290. This is a Gemara from 1290. It had no Mepharshim on the side. It was just a printed Gemara. I mean, somebody hand wrote the Gemara, and that's the way it went.
Was it in scroll form?
It was from a Satan. Is this Ksav Rashi? This is Ksav Rashi, actually. And this is from Avodah Zarah. That's what it had. It has Mishnah, then Gemara. It has no form that we would even recognize today. Actually, I have, I brought in one time years ago, I have a Gemara in my house that my father used in the army. It has the whole Shas in one volume.
Yeah.
There's onion
that.
Skin paper.
I saw that. I saw four pages.
It's approximately three blot on every omelet.
Yeah, I saw that.
Every omelet is so small, but it looks, it's in the same format with four lines of Rashi and Tosis on the top, but the print is so small, it's like my father gave me his army tefillin as a spare, and he gave me his army tefillin. They weigh like a couple of ounces, they weigh a few ounces, and when I, after I got permission, he said, you're not going to believe it, he took it to a sofa to check, and the sofa was just sitting there incredible, and he said, of course this was many years later, he said, they're kosher. But they were so tiny. So obviously a real good cipher wrote it. This was, he said, what he used in the army. And this is the Gemara he had with him for 4 years when he was in the army so that he could learn a little bit. He had a whole Shas with him in one volume. But it's still that thick. I mean, it weighs considerable amount. But it's, you know, so things were written the way it is, and you have like the Tikkun that we used to laugh all the time, the original Tikkun that we use today, they wanted, we used to joke about it, it had so many mistakes, everybody used to say, they want to see the Sefer Torah they copied this from,
yes,
because it was so fussle, it was unbelievable.
Have it at home.
It had so, right, the old one, because the it wasn't matched up, but it was short, the Amud was short. But these are a lot of interesting things. What one of the things that
who's the
Heller? What?
Heller.
Heller, yeah. It says Marvin J. Heller. That's who. No, there was. It wasn't the gentleman who said he published. It was this is his safer. Wasn't that person? It was an elderly gentleman who, when I was giving the shiur here one day, and he overheard me talking about the safer. He said, "That's my book." He says,
he says,
I didn't understand what he meant. I was like going to say, no, that's mine. And he said, and he said, no, I meant, I printed it. So that was as far as that goes. But it's interesting. But getting back to Yaakov. So Yaakov says, he kavtzu v'shimu. What he's saying is a lot of times a father will tell you, I want to tell you what my mistakes were, where I went wrong. And what does he mean by that? Where did Yaakov go wrong? And that all comes back down to the dream. And I've mentioned this before, but I read the same Dvar Torah again and again and again just because sometimes I read something a fourth or a fifth time and I either learn something new from it or realize I didn't understand it the first time. And I remember once at we were sitting around the table at an Ufruf in Israel and I mentioned something, and I said that somebody said something, and another rabbi, much older than I was, slammed his fist on the table and said, I reject that. And what he meant was that I was misquoting the Perush. And so I sat down. I understood what he meant, and everybody thought he was yelling at me that he didn't like what I said in general. But I reread it. And then I had a discussion because I didn't see where I went wrong and he just didn't like the way it sounded. It was a Malbim and he didn't like the way it sounded. I said, but that's what it says. He's very, very careful. It was very easy to read. That's another thing I used to pick when I was younger. I would pick Perushim that I could understand on some level, at least think I did. But nevertheless, you read it sometimes, you have to read it 5 times, 10 times until it sinks in. And so Yaakov is trying to explain now what dream that he had that he misunderstood. And the reason I say misunderstood, because I remember years ago when somebody in Shul came to me, one of the Bachrim came to me and said he didn't understand the Ramban when he says by Vayera that he makes a point of saying that don't think for 1 minute, you know, we get the impression that God spoke to the Avos like we get, Vayedaber Hashem al Moshe Lemo, Vayedaber Vayomer Hashem al Moshe Lemo. It's not the same. They saw visions. They had a dream. They weren't in an awakened state. Maybe they were in a trance or they was in the middle of the night, Vayachalom. And we see that. And the ability to figure out what the dream says is not 100%. And he says, Yaakov, unfortunately, at this point in time, what he realized later on in life was that he misinterpreted the dream of Vinei Sulam Mutzavarza. And I know I've mentioned this before, but he wanted, at this juncture, he's trying to explain to them, he kaftsu v'shimu, I want to tell you where I went wrong. And to tell them that you're going to be in, this is the beginning of Golus, he knows that, and the template for survival is going to be unity, but also we live in Golus, and there's this divergent philosophy. We have some people try to not so much as assimilate, but don't wear their religion on the sleeve. I mean, on some level, you have people who wear their tzitzis out and people who don't want to wear their tzitzis out, who will wear a talis in the street on Shabbos and some who wear the coat over it or don't like to do that in Purim because we're in Golus and they don't like to do it. And there's makom to say either way, but the point is you can't hide. If once you start to hide your Judaism, you begin to rationalize for doing more and more and more. As long as you know that there's no one formula to achieve success. So the truth is, the best I ever felt is when we were going in May of 2012, when I went to Bardiyev for that 3-day, you know, the anniversary of the deportation of the Jews, and the way it worked out, the way the plane schedule was, it almost took a full day from the time I left, because we had to fly to Krakow, then change planes to get to this place, and then take a first fly to Berlin, take another plane to Krakow, and then take a 4-hour bus ride to Bardiyev. This was a long process of a day. And when we got to Berlin, it was in at the time on the clock, I realized, and I said to everybody else, we didn't plan it that way, but there were a few of us who were going to this place at the time on the same plane. People came from all over the world, and there were a few of us on the same, and I said, I think we better daven now, because after we get off the next plane, it's going to be the afternoon, then we get on a bus, we have to catch the bus, it's going to be late in the day before we daven. So here I was, we had it like about an hour before the next plane took off, and it was in Berlin, in this airport, I'm sure they have more than one airport, it was one huge waiting room, it's just one big area. It was easily 1,000 people there, and I was looking for a chair, and I took out my talis and tefillin, and I put it on in the middle for 1,000. I said, we better daven now, and I put it on, and I could feel... It's easy to see. You look around, and people were looking at me like I'm from outer space, and looking at me. And the person, you know, who I was, one of the people who I met on the plane, I didn't know he would be on the plane. He said, "Here, you're going to daven?" I said, "Let them see we're back." And that's what I said to him that time. I said, "We're back," and that's it. This is Berlin, you know. So, but it was a good feeling.
You have courage.
Well, it was, but I said, the only thing is that what made me laugh that time was, I said, other people think was because the only place I could find was, I was looking for some places, if I'm going to daven Shmon Esrei, you bow down. It looked like I was bowing down, there was no Coke machine, it was Pepsi Cola they had over there. It looked like I was paying homage to Pepsi. So when I went modim, you know, I was doing it right to a Pepsi Cola machine. But I thought, you know, that looked funny in that respect. I was trying to avoid it. But, I mean, you know, when I went now on a vacation, we went down to, I was went to Atlanta. We were flying to the airport. We had to get there. The plane was leaving at 5 o'clock in the morning, so I had to daven. And I realized by the time I get there, I didn't want to deal with it. So by the time the plane took off, I had an opportunity to daven at the airport in Kennedy. And I look for a place alone, and I put on my talis and tefillin at the airport early in the morning. And then a Hasidish guy, he walked past me a couple of times, and he kept looking at me, and I didn't know what he was doing. And he came back, and finally, when I was already, I know I was already up to Ashrei already, and then he just stopped, opened up his talis and tefillin, put it on, and davened next to me. He was also he was on a different plane, but he was there early in the morning. But he felt like, okay, if I'm doing it, I just found that at that time in the morning, there were a lot of very empty, deserted places where it was really, you know, fairly secluded. But, you know, you wonder what the... But if in New York, if people are going to look at you strange in New York, again, people know all these things already. So it... don't be afraid. And Yaakov is trying to impart this to his sons, that I'm telling you to live in Goshen. Of course, at least you'll have a chance. I mean, Yosef said, Bavur teshvu b'yeretz Goshen. And to be a part, to have that shtetl mentality, that's what you want. That's the best way to survive. But nevertheless, and of course, as we know, Vayifru Vayechozu Ba was the beginning of the end in reality, as Chazal tell us. But he still wanted to tell them, as long as they achieve a certain modicum of unity, that is the template for survival, and that whenever the time comes, so I'm not trying to give you a date when he didn't realize, I'm just trying to tell you that my mistake was I didn't climb the ladder. I didn't climb the ladder because he saw the ladder, the angels going up and the angels going down, and he looked at it again. This is Rabbi Alpert, what he says in his Sefer, that he looked, and he says it in Vayechi, he said he saw the angels going up and coming down, and he was trying to tell the people what he interpreted the dream was, that God was telling him to be careful, don't push the envelope, don't try to climb the ladder, because if you go up, you're going to get knocked off, and you're going to end up going down. What the message was that he realized was, he was telling that for everybody but him. Other people will get knocked down. If you, as a Jew, will climb the ladder, you will be able to achieve the heights. For you, I will help. And that's what he was saying. Yosfu v'yagidu lochem, eis asher yikro eschem b'achris hayomim. What you can achieve, how you will achieve the gula when you are depressed, when things look their worst. I'm telling you, you're going to give, maybe you reach the point where you give up. You think you're living in a place where there is no hope. You're giving up. It's the Holocaust, and you're thinking that Judaism will not survive this calamity. This is how you regroup and get back. I need you to understand, this is the way we could get back up on our feet and achieve a gula. So when you're in Mitzrayim and things descend to the way they are, Vayezaku b'nei Yisrael al Hashem, batal shavosom, when you think of what's going on and when you think that things can't get any worse, this is how you begin to regroup and achieve a mentality of gula. The problem became is very hard to be, it's easy to say. And you get people, and here was, they experienced 10 makos and they went out of Mitzrayim. And as we know, what we've seen in history with the Civil War, when people are enslaved for a very long time, they have what psychologists call a slave mentality. And they can't do things. It's like when the recidivism for people who've been in jail is great because they don't know how to live in the outside world. They don't know how to live when they have to make their own decisions, and they feel more comfortable. There are people who are forever soldiers. They re-enlist because they don't know what else to do about it. And the same thing over here. They were free, and they didn't know how to go out and be on their own. It took the next generation. And so when it said Yom LaShana, Yom LaShana, the reality was, we know that, you know, because it was 40 days, but the reality is God gave them a sentence of 40 years. We attribute it to the 40 days that they were gone, okay, but just as easily God could have said 20 years, 10 days, you know, for an hour, for a minute, for a year, whatever it is. What was 40 years? What was the significance of 40 years? We know he gives us that formula. But the reality is he knows that it will clear out this generation. You still need parents to grow up and guide you to some level, but nevertheless, these people cannot be the foundation of a new nation in Eretz Yisrael, because it's always, you're going to have people who grow up who are willing to take chances, be out on their own, be their own bosses, and then there are people who grow up and just are afraid of their own shadow, and it's your upbringing in life that causes how you do. I'm just looking over here in general. All right. This is the part of the Chalom. So this is, interestingly enough also, what it says in the Parsha is when he says at the beginning of the Parsha, and immediately he starts off and he says to Yosef, when after it says, Vayichi Yaakov b'Eretz Mitzrayim Shvas Reishonah, and very good, 147, so it says, Vayikrevu Yemei Yisrael Omos, so it says, I told you that Nistimu Einayim Shel Yisrael, and so on and so forth. And he's, what does he say to Yosef? Al Nosik Bereini B'Mitzrayim. What he says is very interesting, when he says, Al Nosik Bereini V'Shochavti Mavosai, and all these things, Vayomer Yishoval, when Yosef, and what does Yosef answer? Onochi Esek Kidvorecha. And then he says, Vayomer Yishovali. So, some of the Mepharshim will say right there, the reason he asked him to swear now, that he didn't trust him, because he wanted him to be able to say to Paro that, I swore to my father, so he'll appreciate that kind of situation. But the Rabbi Benel makes a very interesting thing, and he makes a point here of saying, when Yosef said, Vayomar anochi esechid vorecha, he wasn't saying, I'll do what you asked me to bury you in Eretz Yisrael. He was saying, you want to be buried in Eretz Yisrael? And Yosef answer, anochi esechid vorecha. Yeah, you know what? I want to do that too. I also want to be buried in Eretz Yisrael. Vayomer, Anochi Esechid Vorecha. Me too. I want to be buried in Eretz Yisrael as well. And Yaakov knew this. He saw B'nevua that Yosef would be buried in Eretz Yisrael. But what he's saying, he says, I know you want to be buried in Eretz Yisrael, but you're going to be here until the Gula. I don't want to be here till the Gula. So you're telling me, don't worry, I'll bury you in Eretz Yisrael. But so you'll say, all right, listen, Don't worry, Daddy, I'll bury you in Eretz Yisrael. I'll not sit the rainy bit, it's right. But he said, I don't want to be there for 1 second ever. So he says, he shoveli, and that's what he's saying to him. He was saying, you're not getting what I'm telling you, the full flavor of what I'm really asking you. You don't understand. I know you want to be buried there, but you're going to be there. I don't want to be there.
Why don't you follow through and say that he made him swear that Yosef would be buried and would make sure that he himself be buried in Eretz Yisrael, and therefore Yosef would make a kal v'chomer. If I took a shvuah that I myself will guarantee that I'm buried, so certainly for my father. For the father, he wouldn't even need a shavuot. If you would make a shavuot for yourself, the guilt he would have in doing for himself
and not for his father.
Father would be even greater than a shavuot to guarantee that he would make sure that.
Okay, but still, Yaakov liked to cross his T's and dot his I's, you know, and so he was very careful about everything. To him, the words were, many times we've said in Shir, just because you do the right thing doesn't mean there's consequences. Doesn't mean there's not consequences. And that really comes into play. And why did Yaakov have to, which gave me the thought, is why did Yaakov have to suffer? It wasn't him who, it was Rivka's idea to take the Bechorah. But really, when you think about it, why did Yaakov, when Yaakov said, Ulai, you know, instead of Ulai Yimusheni Ovi, you know, so what a Chazal say, it doesn't say Penny Musheni Ovi, it says Ulai, means you want it to happen, you don't want to be caught, you don't want to go through with it, you're not a liar, and you can't handle it. But the reality is, so I like to always think, I used to always say that Yaakov liked to take responsibility. He could have said to Esav, don't blame me, mommy made me do it. Mommy told me to do it. Why not? But Yaakov understood, you know, like you say, ain't shlech l'dvar avera, you know, you want to do. You have to learn to take responsibility for things you do. But Yaakov went through with it for a different reason. He liked to, he always, the Avos were able to put two and two together. When he was 15, and the Parsha begins in Toldos, when Vayivez Esav Esav Chora, when he says, when Esav says to Maliteni no, Mino Adomo Adomo Azek, Yoyef Anochi, what's on Yaakov's mind at this time? Vayim Kores Vichora Sol Yaakov. And he's following through on what's been on his mind for 48 years at this point in time. He never forgot it. And he said, okay, you know, I see that maybe this is the way it's going to have to be. So it's not that he felt, he realized that he couldn't even say, mommy made me do it, because I was on board with the whole scenario. I'm thinking this is the way it is meant to be. So I'm going to do it. And all right, ulayi musheni avi, but nevertheless, if it works out that way, and that's why you would think that Yaakov at the end, when Yosef says, Sikel es yodov kimenasheh habachor, he says, yodati b'ni yodati. What does yodati b'ni yodati mean? He says, I want you to know, I know all these things that happen. I understand. And he makes a point of saying over here, I know everything that happened. I know the whole story. Abarbanel is of the opinion that at this juncture, and before that, Yaakov knew the whole story. As opposed to there's differences of opinion. But he says that Yaakov knew exactly what happened, and he says, Yodati v'ni yodati. I know what happened, that because I played favoritism with you, look what happened, and now you're concerned that I'm going to mess up. And this is the way I saw it as a kid. You know, I used to joke with my father, you know, because you have siblings and you have these fights. Daddy likes you, daddy likes you. No, daddy likes you, mommy likes you, whatever it is. And however it works. The fact is, he says, I know what happened. I know what caused it. It doesn't change anything. Yodati b'ni yodati. I know exactly where this is going. But it doesn't mean I used to joke, and I said it once before, you know, you give us, I used to tell one rabbi, don't give these analogies from television shows when you're making a speech. He once gave a Maisa Shahaya, and he used, a rabbi that we've quoted here in Shira a lot of times, that you've read things that he wrote, and he published already 3 svar, but when he was young, before he had a shtela, and he was just in the process of getting smicha, he would be making a speech and he would say, like it says, he saw it on The Simpsons, or he gave a raya Meister Shahaya from Mesh, and I would say, don't do that. You know, that's not what you want to be known for, is, you know, for Homer Simpson as the making speeches. But, and which unfortunately happened in his circles, as we used to joke about it. But nevertheless, he's not that kind of a, you wouldn't hear that from him anymore. But, you know, so that's because he grew up a Baal Tshuva. Anyhow, but he had big yichus, has big yichus. He wasn't brought up that way, and he became that way. He went to Eretz Yisrael and came back a different person. His parents never saw it coming. So that's it. But the point is, he understood. Yodati b'ni yodati. I got it. Don't worry. I understand. But I'm not afraid. I was 0-for-15 shooting tonight. I'm still taking the last shot. I know what it's like. I understand everything from the get-go. Doesn't mean I will change my modus operandi. I know I chose. The one thing he makes a point of saying over here was, so how come if he's doing everything with Yosef, when he gives out the brachas, all of a sudden, when he says, Yehuda, ato yoducha achecha, when he says, lo yosur shevet mihuda, and he says that Yaakov never intended, even at this juncture, to put the mantle of leadership in the hands of Yehuda. Because all he would think about was, if he's taking away from Reuven, he is 100% in his mind putting the mantle of leadership, which seemed to be the very obvious, the most obvious choice was, he was, Yosef was going to be the Malucha 100%. But when he started to wax poetic and give the brachas, this is where God took over. And when he gave the brachas and he said, Lo Yosu Shevet Nehuda, this was no longer Yaakov talking, so to speak. And the same way we always ask the question, when Yitzchak gave the bracha to Yaakov, the obvious question is, when he says, Gam Baruch Yiyeh, after he realizes when Esav comes in and says, you know, where's my bracha? And he says, your brother took the bracha, I gave it to your brother. It's a Mekach Toz, at least say, why not say? But he realized that it wasn't coming from him. It was coming from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And Yaakov is overcome by the fact that he is now realized saying, Lo Yosur Shevet Mihuda, and he is also, in a way, just, what did I say? I'm giving the Malucha to Yehuda. I didn't intend this to be that way. I didn't know it. But, of course, if he realizes that he said it, he is of the, you know, if we make, so to speak, a Freudian slip, we say it's a Freudian slip. Yaakov is not on the level that any of us are on. He understands. We can't begin to appreciate what people of that caliber are, their mind is like. I often wonder how we would judge if, you know, they tell us that the average person uses approximately 10 to 12% of his brain power when he in his life. And that's why we get the expression, keeping the gray matter in the pink. And that's how they know, by the way, when they dissect a body and they take out the brain, the part of the brain that's been used has a different color. It's pink, and the matter that's been unused is gray. And so that's how they say, so the average person, and they said probably Einstein used somewhere between 15 and 20% of his brain. That's why he was able. I often wonder what the brain of Moshe Rabbeinu would look like being on the level that he was, what percentage of his capacity. But the point what I'm making is what kind of abilities we all have, the capabilities we have to achieve. And that's what I'm saying now. You have the ability, if we're retired or have more time, how much time do we give it? I mean, I sit there and sometimes I could sit at a table for an hour. I'm not trying to say it like this, but when I used at one point in time when I was out of work for about 4 months many years ago, I started to learn at night. And I would fall asleep early in the day and I would wake up like on a Friday especially, and I would get up around midnight, not, this wasn't by design, and I would go down in the living room and open up a sefer and learn till about 3, 4 in the morning. But what I realized after doing this a few times was the blot gemara that I learned in the middle of the night, it really sunk in. The amount of silence, you could be alone, but somehow there's daily noise, there's interruptions and things like that. But what you could achieve in the middle of the night is unbelievable. And I saw that because it was just deathly silent. At 2 o'clock in the morning, if you don't hear any sounds every night except the Saturday night, you're going to hear, I know in my neighborhood, you could hear 3 o'clock in the morning, people screaming. But nevertheless, on a regular weekday night, you could really, if you're concentrating, really learn and absorb a lot. And I would sit there and just mull over something in my mind 10, 15 times. And that's the importance of being Mava Sedra. You get used to hearing the phrases, and you hear from one pasuk from this parsha to this parsha, and it just bounces back and forth. We all have that ability to say it and think and think and think. And that's what all, how do you think the Rishonim or all the people that write Svarim operate? They just have these thoughts. It's not, no, but they weren't spoon-fed. They clear their mind of everything they read, and that's why a lot of times I choose not to read somebody else, because I don't want my mind clouded. I want to say over the pasuk and see what it's saying to me. And that's how we move on in the world. And you'd be surprised what you could think of, because everyone who's here has that capacity. And you could see that by the give and take. Well, that I wrote already. So what I wanted to do now, if we'll take a break at this point in time for a few minutes, and then we'll go on after that with something else. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I just...
Yeah, sure.
When did this come out?
A long time ago. I probably have it at least 30 years. What year does it say?
It's Levitz. Im HaSefer. He's here on 18th
Street. All right, I don't know.